This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3575 for Friday, the 15th of April, 2022. Today's show is entitled, An Edinburgh Blether. It is hosted by Dave Morris and is about 62 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Brooks and Dave Morris catching up after nearly a year.
Hello, everybody. This is Dave Morris for Hacker Public Radio, and I'm joined today by Mr. X. Hi, Mr. X. How are you doing?
Hello, Dave. Very long time no here.
That's true enough. It's true enough. Yeah, I was looking. Our last show was back last year in April.
Yeah, so I can't believe it was as long as that.
It doesn't seem that long at all, does it? It's funny how time is warping. That's what I've written down here. COVID time warp gets us again.
Indeed. Really strange.
I also made a note to myself to say, in my mind, not a lot has happened. But as I was writing the sort of notes thingy that we share about the sort of things we can talk about, there's tons. It's a weird thing.
And I think if you hadn't written your, because you had your notes ahead of mine, so I'm thinking, oh, that reminds me of this and that reminds me of that. So that gave me a few ideas as well. So, yeah.
It's astonishing that the COVID time has done weird, weird things to our minds, I think, in terms of, you know, the perception of time is weird, but still.
Yeah. Anyway. It's funny, without going into any details on what I'm about to say, just to mention it, but I was listening to the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, and there was a presenter talking, and he was saying, you know, when Brexit happened, it's a UK thing, we'll go into no details about that, but he said, when that happened, that'll be the defining moment in my career, and I'll never forget that. And then COVID kicked off, he says, oh, that'll be the defining moment in my career, I'll never forget that. And then, of course, what's happening just now has kicked off, which I won't go into, and then, my God, what's going to happen next?
Indeed. Yeah, all these people saying, well, I hope 2022 is going to be better than the 21, and
indeed. Mad.
It is. So, do you want to, I haven't really written anything about Christmas in my list. Did you want to mention how your Christmas has been? Or have you got anything else you want to start with?
No, it's fine. It's the first thing I guess, when you talk about not much had happened, and at that point, maybe Christmas didn't seem quite so far off, but it seems a very, very long time ago now. And Christmas was very, very quiet, and I spent time at my mum's, basically, and my brother took the very wise decision of not coming up at that time. He thought, well, it's not so much himself, but he thought, well, you know, I'm going to be a lot of public transport and mixing with a lot of people, and he didn't want to bring a wee present home with him, sort of thing. So I was quite surprised and touched, because I wasn't sure. I mean, I wasn't going to lay down the law and say to him, well, you know, you shouldn't come up or whatever, but I was pleasantly surprised he made that decision himself. So, but I had a good time, and my mother pulled out all the stops and did her famous marshmallow trifle, which was stupendous. I'm sure he was very jealous when we sent him pictures of it, you know.
very good. Yeah, well, that's what Christmas is all about, isn't it? So, yeah, I didn't really do very much for Christmas. My family go off and do their own thing to a certain degree. My son goes off to his girlfriend's parents, who are very, very keen Christmas celebrators. Me, I'm not so bad. But we all got together at various points, so that was all good fun. So.
Yeah, that's all that matters, isn't it? Absolutely. And then, of course, you know, I was not looking at your notes, and you've had all kinds of trials and tribulations and sort of domestic problems. I don't know if you want to. Well, actually, you've got a bit before that, because you were talking about your family. I'm kind of jumping ahead here. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It was just to say, really, that there was big upheavals in my family, I guess you'd say. My son, who's been a student for the past on and off. No, he's been a student, really, apart from some gap years, because youngsters take gap years a lot of the time these days. He'd been a student, and he he turned 30 last year, so
all right.
He was in perpetual student mode, and so he finished his MSc last year. I went to his graduation, not been to one of them before, it was fun, and then he landed a job working in a bank.
Wow.
Big international bank as a coder. So,
wow, very so good, very good.
He's an AI specialist. That's what his wow. MSc was in. So.
Yeah, a huge change, you know, to be in academia for, you know, for so long, and then suddenly jump from that to a job. It must be a big change. But something to be very proud of and whatnot. It's quite impressive.
I think banks quite like, you know, people who've gone and got quite refined specialist degrees and stuff.
Understandable,
but,
yeah.
But you can apparently get on board with many banks as a sort of, as before you even get a degree, or maybe you're not even going to get a degree, and then be trained up through the ranks there, you know,
with a
goal of becoming a software engineer or whatever. So, it's a bit like university.
Ever perpetual at university. What do you know what language he's using? Do you know?
He's writing quite a lot in Python just now, but he's trained in Java. He's but Python, you do quite a lot of AI stuff in Python, so
right.
He tends to use it for sort of prototyping things.
It's funny, a colleague of mine used to be a pleb engineer such as myself, and he ended up in software, and he said they do about surprisingly bits and pieces in Python and whatnot, and he was really quite impressed with it. And he said, you know, speed wise, it really isn't a problem, unless you're talking about really, really sort of low level tight integration stuff where there's latency concerns and whatnot. But other than that, it's absolutely good enough. And you know, he raves about it. I was quite surprised to hear him say that, you know. But yeah.
Well, there's also Python versions for, you know, single board computers and that and also microcontrollers. I mean, like, for example, I've got a Raspberry Pi Pico, which I haven't really used yet, but you can run a micro Python on there and do some fairly effective stuff.
Right, okay.
Be better writing an assembler or a C or something, but if you really want to be very responsive, but you can still do a fair bit of stuff, I think.
Oh, right. Very good. Very good. Yeah.
The other personal family stuff was my daughter also got a job. She finished her MSc a couple of years ago now and been job hunting, and then she's landed something working at Dundee University. So she's out of Edinburgh, getting set up with a flat in Dundee. But, you know, she...
That'll be obviously her moving away. That'll be, and she's been obviously in the area for so long. That'll be a bit of a change as well for her, as much as you, I suppose.
But yeah. She does have a friend in Dundee, so that's quite good. So
that's
she's
good.
Not yes. She's not completely yes. launched out into the the nasty world. But it's good.
Yeah, good. Oh, excellent stuff. Oh, so they're all everyone's moving on, and I guess nothing stays the same. That's the thing. Is always change. That's the thing. I must admit, I'm not very good with change, but I like things to stay the same.
No, exactly. Like exactly. As a parent, it's slightly disturbing when your kids, you suddenly realise they're not just these things you have to stuff food in and send off to school. they're actually full blown people. And my son has skills now that I'm not going to be able to reach. You know. Well, he does come to me for advice on occasion.
Yeah,
Dad, how would you do this? And blah, blah, blah. But, and my daughter, too, to some extent. You realise it's sort of semi-redundant as a parent. comes to us all,
good.
I think.
Yes, I suppose. Yeah, very good, very good. So, that's interesting, yes. And then, of course, you were, you also... Of course, you also had other personal things going on as well, because you weren't too well either. That was a bit of a shock.
I know. It's when you reach a certain age, over 60, they reckon, and if you've had chickenpox, then the chances are you're going to get shingles unless you take some action against it. And shingles is the same virus as chickenpox, and right. it sits in your nervous system all the time since you had the chickenpox, waiting until your immune system gets weak enough that it can attack you again. So I got a really heavy attack of the shingle in January.
And of course, as you age, your immune system does weaken as well. Mm-hmm. Yep. I knew that. So I didn't know that. So you said, unless you take action, what action can you take?
Well, you can get a vaccine. There's a shingles vaccine that's available. It's not a thing that's instantly offered. But when I went to my doctors with the shingles, he said, okay, once you're over this, then speak to us and we'll organize a vaccine, because it'll come back. It can come back again and again. So it does. I don't know how effective it is, but it certainly helps to some degree. So
yeah, I think because my mother always used to say, well, we don't know if you had chickenpox or not, because I think my brother got it and I came up with one spot and the doctor said, yeah, it looks very much like chickenpox, but that was all I had, so we don't know really. So
yeah, I had it twice as a kid. I had a fairly mild dose of it. It hardly was off the air for more than a day or two. But then I got it again within a few months, and it was absolutely devastating. I was in bed for over a week, I think. Oh, absolutely not flat. So I think I had that. This was the the viruses of the big attack were still sitting in my system, or their descendants were. Well, a weird disease that it gets you, and then it sits waiting for another opportunity to come back and beat you up again. It's a miserable thing.
indeed. You know, I know that you kind of come from kind of background of that sort of side of things, and that you there's a podcast that you listen to and all that, but there's just so much that's you know you just take your good health for granted, sort of thing. You don't know that all these. I think it'd probably terrify you to death if you knew all the known sort of viruses and whatnot that are going around. You know.
Yes, indeed. It doesn't do to dwell on it too much.
No.
I think if you get into medicine, I don't know quite. You must sort of have a means of switching your brain off to your own condition. You know.
Yeah, so that must really. You know, absolutely. Yes, of course. Never thought of that.
Seeing people come through the door with all these horrible things, and if you stop and think, oh, that could be me, and it's going to really mess you up, I would have thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I mean, I could go into, and this is not on our list of things, but I've been watching that. What's it? This is going to hurt. You know, have you seen the drama? This is going to hurt.
No,
it was about a doctor.
No, I've not seen that. No.
No. So I got the book, and I think my wife got me the book or something, and read that. It's a story of a junior NHS doctor and basically what he went through. He ended up having it just got too much of him, and it broke him basically, and he gave up. And it was just showing how difficult it is for these junior doctors, you know, on A&E or whatever it is. He was in the sort of childbirth sort of thing area, but it was it was horrendous. You know, I won't say anymore actually.
Yeah, well, it's true though. It's true. It can be pretty devastating. You've got to be made of tough stuff to work in that sort of world, I think.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So I was going to say
we've got a common topic here, which is to do with boilers and stuff.
Yes, that's right.
Do you want to talk about yours?
Well, okay. So my in-laws, they've got a thing about boilers. I think, you know, they had many years ago, they had a boiler blow up, and they had a boiler in their last house in the garage, and it blew up. They kind of had a bang, and water came up from under the door and all that sort of stuff. And so I think, and it's maybe an age thing as well. As you get a bit older, you get a bit more less confident, let's say. So I think they're always a bit nervous about anything going wrong with their boiler. And they do seem to have had an unusually amount of bad luck with their boilers. So in this new house, so I think I don't know how old this boiler would be. It was as old as 10 years, maybe it wasn't quite, I don't know. But anyway, it was it failed. And the man came round and had a look at it, and he sort of condemned it and decommissioned it, sort of thing. And of course, this was in the middle of the, well, the weather's not, well, it's actually lovely and bright and sunny today, but it's quite cold outside, but it was horrible at this point in time. And they were 10 days without heating and hot water. Now, of course, I was visiting my own mother, and she says, "Oh, but they'll have an immersion heater." I said, "Oh, so they will. I never thought on that, you know." So I sort of spoke to I spoke to them about it, but you know, the builder at the time said, "Oh, don't touch that switch." And they had it in their mind, if you touch that switch, the house will fall down or something. So they wouldn't turn the automation heater on, you know. I think eventually they did near the end. But at that point, they'd lasted a long time with kettles and whatnot. And they came to our house to have a bath and all this sort of stuff. It was just not very good for them at all. But it must be horrendous, you know.
Ah, really grim. Wow.
Yeah. So that thing. So while that was happening, the chap came to repair it, and he did some pressure testing on the gas, and found it was unusually low. So that indicates a gas leak. So we need to find that whatever it is, you know. But there's a possibility we might need to pull up your floorboards, and if we can't find it there, we might need to go under your driveway. I'm thinking, well, you know, what if it's halfway down the street and it's all the houses in the street have to get all the floorboards and stuff. Look, it could be anywhere, you know, this is what happened. Yeah. So, but fortunately, it turned out to be a leak behind the cooker. So that was nice and easy. Thank God for that, you know. So that was that. Oh, that's it. All sorted in. The man set it up, put it on, turned it on. There you go. That's it. Fine. Great. End of your problems. And after he'd gone away, so I'll just turn the boiler off then, shall I? Click. Oh, it's still on. Click, but still on. Click, still on. So it wouldn't turn off, you know. So I had a look. I downloaded the manual for it, and there's three wires that connect to the timer unit. I thought, he's probably got something wrong with that. That's what it'll be. But eventually, the chap. Now, obviously, you could turn it off manually from the boiler itself. So eventually the chap came round and he was scratching his head, and he spent ages apparently trying to work out what was going on. Finally, he checked the wiring. Oh, what's that? I thought, oh my God, I could have told you that straight away, you know. For some reason, it took him an awful long time to come to that conclusion. You know?
Oops. Yeah. It's important to get that sort of stuff right.
Yeah.
It's more inconvenient than dangerous, of course. But
it's still
a damn nuisance.
Yeah, I think probably what it was is that he couldn't conceive that the previous fitter had wired it incorrectly, so he was going for everything else. So I guess obviously when you're too close to the thing, sometimes you can be blinded, or don't mm-hmm. look for the most obvious mm-hmm. things, sort of things. I guess that's what's happened, really. You know,
sort of troubleshooting stuff. Doesn't always operate in every corner, I guess, is it?
No, this is it. So what about you? You had, yours was pretty horrendous, even worse, I would say, than what we had, you know, my God.
Yeah, I don't know whether I don't think any of this happened prior to our previous chat, because according to my records, somewhere in sort of late March, early April last year, I was in downstairs in an area, a sort of dining area, and I suddenly got a drip of water on my head. And what is that? So the room directly above was my daughter's old bedroom. She's not used that as a bedroom for, probably never will. But I went up and had a look, and it was drenched. There was water coming through the ceiling. The whole plasterboard of the ceiling was sagging down, full of water. You know, so
absolutely horrendous.
I went to the attic, and it was just over the cold water tank. So,
right.
I mean, people who don't know British, old fashioned British plumbing tends to work on the principle that you have some sort of heating source. It used to be a back boiler behind a coal fire back in the old days. And that's how this is a 1970s era house. So it's plumbed that way. And that would go up to, that would actually feed a hot water tank, which kept the water hot. But it would actually be fed by a cold water tank, which was a sort of reservoir that gets filled from the mains. So that was what was above. At some point, the original tank was still there. It was an old sort of steel thing. But I'd had, years and years ago, had a new tank put in. They didn't want to take out the old one because it was a big pain. And so they just put the new tank, a plastic one, over the top of it. So it was on a sort of structure which was holding it up over the top of the old tank. And in doing so, they cut off the outflow from the old tank and connected it to the new tank. You know, it's just the overflow thing. Somehow or other, water was coming out of this plastic tank and dripping into the old tank. And then it was running out of this cut off dangling pipe through crikey. And then into the ceiling. So yeah, it.
So it wasn't even the old tank that failed. It was the flipping new plastic one that failed.
It was, yeah. Eventually,
oh, God.
But what I did was, well, my daughter and I, because my ability to scramble about underneath on attic floors and stuff like that, and poke around with plumbing and stuff is not so good. My knees are not very forgiving. But between us, we managed to grab some more pipe. From the DIY, connect it to the old overflow, and also to the newer overflow, and then have a sort of T piece in it, which then ran to a pipe that runs out the edge of the eaves of the house, and then drips down the side. So so that stopped the water actually coming into the attic. But I felt quite proud of doing that, actually.
Well done. I mean, I think we had something kind of similar many years ago, and there was a wee bit of water dripping through the spare bedroom. And when I looked out, it turned out there was a plastic tank, and what was happening was, the builders, during obviously fitting the tank, obviously had an idea of they cut a hole for a pipe, and they thought, oh no, that's the wrong place. So they got a bit of plastic, a bit of glue, and slapped it over the hole. And obviously, over time, it decided, well, I'm not going to hold anymore, and started to leak.
It's the wrong glue.
Yeah, but you should never. You should never do it that way in the first place. Slap
you
a bit of plastic
put a,
over
a pressure and, thingy in there, shouldn't you?
Yeah.
Which fixes from both sides, type of thing, is it?
Well, that's right. And I couldn't work out. You know, I'm thinking, because it's got a jacket on it. I'm thinking, well, how is it leaking? There's nowhere it can leak from. And it's only when I eventually pulled the jacket away, I thought, what's this bit of plastic? And I was flapping, and I thought, oh, for God's sake, you know. So I got a plumber's fitting that fitted that hole, and you got a cap which you can screw on, which seals it, and that was as simple as that, which is what they should have done in the first place. So, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. luckily, it didn't come to the situation whereby, you know, the ceiling was almost down and through to the living room and all that sort of stuff. That was horrendous.
It was grim. So, we couldn't get a plumber very quickly, but we did manage to book somebody. But he was going to be a few weeks before he arrived, so doing our own leak containment was important. But
I get an
estimate for the tank replacement. It was going to cost about £2,000 to do it.
Crikey.
The guy reckoned.
So, wow.
So I looked, because I had a boiler in the kitchen. The back of the wall of the kitchen venting out to the side wall of the house, and I also had my hot water tank just sort of underneath it in the kitchen, underneath a worktop. Right. So I got some advice, and all the neighbours say, "Oh no, we got all that ripped out ages ago." So I got somebody to come in and take out all of these tanks. The one for the central heating, there's a header tank for the central heating to keep the pressure up.
Right.
The
one,
the cold water tank, the hot water tank, the old boiler. You can put a new boiler up in the attic on the outside wall of the gable end of the house. And so This is the most bizarre pipework you've ever seen, because it comes up the middle of the house and then goes right across the other end of the house, and it's a new gas pipe and all these stuff. But it's much, much better. It's fantastic. So.
Right. Yeah, I can imagine like, people from around the world listening to this and not understanding all these tanks that are around your house. It's just.
I know. I think I was watching somebody setting up a house, in an American guy doing this, and he had installed a pressurized system, which is what I've now got. So the boiler is kept at pressure by the mains pressure. And so that means that the radiators and all the water fittings are coming out at mains pressure. Even the hot water comes out at mains pressure. So and it's also a combi boiler, so you get instant heat.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I say instant. It takes a little while for it to switch to full blast and for it to get through all this miles of pipework. But it's so much better.
Ah, good. We've still got a tank, which obviously these are quite inefficient. And my mother had a shower in our old house. It was a higher altitude, kind of higher up the hill from where I live. And she was always having a problem with her electric shower, because you probably know the way these things work is it's the flow rate across the heater that determines the temperature. So that's how, when you turn the knob to change the temperature, it's adjusting the flow rate. It's not doing anything to the heater at all. And if you've not got sufficient flow rate to get a cool enough temperature, then the shower says, oh no, this is outside of range, and turns the heater off, then it goes stone cold. You go, oh! and then it turns stuff back on and it goes roasting hot. Because there's not enough flow, so it's hot, cold, hot, cold. Yeah. So it drives you nuts. So what you can do, I mean, you could turn it to level one, where it only puts on one heater rather than two, but it's a big rough change, and that means you can only get a trickle through the shower head before it gets too cool. So you either have a trickle or you have it going hot and cold all the time. So because we live quite high up as well, I was determined not to have that situation, because it used to drive me demented. And so we got a shower that gets fed, and it's a bit unusual, it gets fed from the hot water tank. It has a power shower and it mixes the things together. What it means is you can adjust the flow rate to anything you like. You can turn taps off and on, it doesn't affect anything. So it is great, but obviously the boiler tank is inefficient. And that's something, and especially the way things are at the moment, that's maybe not a good idea.
Well, that's right. When I consider that my old boiler would start up, I don't know, 6:30 or something, and then it would heat the water in the hot tank, which would then be available for whatever you want to do in the morning. I've got a gravity shower, so because the head of water from the attic is on the ground floor, so it would get pretty good pressure from there. And one of these with a thermostatic tap on it, and that worked great. But of course, you wouldn't use all of that water, the hot water, so it would just spend the day cooling down, and then come the evening, it would start again and start heating it up again. Had water for whatever, baths or whatever you want to do, washing up and stuff.
I know.
Not efficient at all.
And of course, we've got storage heating, so it's costing us a fortune. So I dread to think what's going to happen. We're on a fixed plan at the moment. I dread to think what's going to happen when that comes to an end. Never thought we'd get into so much plumbing, but it's funny. I had a conversation again, another conversation with the in-laws about this, and I was saying to them that they live in quite a reasonable sized house, it's bigger than they actually need, but it was difficult because when they moved the house last time, it seems, and I've spoken to people before about this, and they couldn't seem to grasp it. They'd say, oh no, builders only build what the market, what people want. I said, no, it's not the case. If they know they can get, more money from, I think they make more money from flats or from houses with, quite a number of rooms in them. And, because what you found was that I think by law, they had to make so many say, two-bedroom houses, and it was obviously the minority. Say they'd have 10 two-bedroom houses and they'd have 50 of these much bigger houses. What they found is that they go to a builder and these houses were all sold out before they were even built. So there's obviously pent-up demand for people wanting to buy these two-bedroom houses, but the builders are not prepared to build them. So it's the market's all broken, basically, you know. But so that's how they end up with this big house. And so they've got this huge big tank, you know, and they won't, you know, say, oh, the water's not hot enough. Now, of course, as you know, we probably know by law, they limit the temperature of these thermostats on these things now so that you can't burn yourself. But I said to them, you know, look, if you put your hand under that hot water tap, can you hold it there? No. Well, how can it be too cold then? You know, you're obviously putting too much hot water. Oh, but I waste all my hot water. But I said, you know, actually, it makes sense to have your boiler, other than worrying about Legionnaires' disease, that might be an issue. But if you turn the temperature down to almost the maximum temperature that you require and not add any hot water, then the lower the temperature, then the slower it'll cool down and the much less energy it'll take to heat it up. So you save power by running it at a lower temperature. But do you think you could grasp that? No.
It's I mean, these things are sort of ingrained in older people. I mean, I'm kind of myself. I mean, when I was a kid, we just we had no heating in our house other than the coal fire in the main room.
I can remember that.
With a back boiler, and then there was a hot water tank through in a cupboard in one of the bedrooms, and so you'd light the fire, but you wouldn't leave it on all day. You'd come back from whatever. I often used to come back from school and be asked to build a fire, and then you'd have that going pretty strong to make enough hot water so you could have a bath later on, you know. And then you know, and you'd be going and checking your hot water tank. Is it hot yet? Is it hot yet? You know.
Well, we had gas. I think we did a coal, but that's going. I was very young at the time. But my granny had that, and she had a damper. Do you remember the damper? And I think they had like a pole.
They
pull it up the chimney, and you pull this thing up or down or something to do something. I'm not quite sure what it did because I never got near it myself. But do you know about dampers and how they work and what they are?
I think it was a sort of slider that went backwards and forwards because. When you looked up the chimney in our house, there was a sort of metal rod poking down from the back of the chimney, and you'd grab that with some tongs or something, and then slide it forward, and that would close off the main chimney, and it would make the heat go up around the back, which joined in with the chimney, and it would it'd be sending it all to the back boiler, I think.
Was there not a song about the damper and the smoke will go up the chimney the same way or something? I'm sure there was a song about that, you know, from my childhood, I can remember.
Probably was,
So feel free for anyone to write in if they know what that song is.
I can't think of anything. But yeah, my dad bought a new bungalow in Norwich, which is in East Anglia, if you're not from these parts. And we'd moved from London to get away from the smog. And bought this new bungalow, and it came with all this stuff. And we were amazed at how wonderful the fact that there was a gas point next to the fire, and that was where you plugged in your gas poker, so you could light the fire without having to go in all this hassle
gas poker.
Of newspaper and bits of stick and stuff, and making a fire that you then had to put coal on top of. You actually just threw coal in and poked this poker into it. A lit poker into it, and it would set the stuff start going.
That's incredible. Well, funny with the gas poker, I can remember the pipes being at the fire and all that. But you just reminded me of something. That I was one of the relatives had I think they moved house, and we visited them, and they had the cooker, and they had this. It was a white cooker, and it had this one thing on the end with a cable. And I was suddenly transformed to a little boy. It's funny how some things happen. You think, oh, I just remember that, you know, because when I was a wee boy, One of my grannies had a cooker, and it had a pipe that came down the side, and it had a kind of wand thing, and you lit it, and that was to light the rings, you know.
Yeah.
And this cooker had that. Now, at that point, when I was a wee boy, it must have been an ancient cooker then. And I remember, the only thing I remember is when I used to go to my granny's kitchen, is this smell of gas, you know. And of course, when I was in these relatives' house, I thought, I can smell gas. Nothing's changed in all that time. I couldn't believe it, you know. So God knows how old that cooker was. But
I do remember those. I can't remember. Maybe my grandmother had one. I can't remember exactly. But I do remember those things. They were supposed to switch off. You poke the sort of rod thing that you put the flame to into a socket, which is meant to turn the gas off, I think. But I don't know how effective that ever was.
Yeah. And do you remember the it was like a big cylindrical battery, I think, and you screwed something up or something, and had it was like an igniter. It started to glow at the tip, and that was used to light gas as well.
Yes, either that or a thingy with a flint in it, like from a gas lighter. You could buy a pack of flints from the tobacconist, and you it's a thing you clicked, and it would shoot sparks out, which would light the gas.
yes.
Those were
the days.
And that was coal gas in my day. I remember all the gasometers around where we used to live.
Oh, that's right. Of course, that's another bowl of contention, isn't it? Because they've got rid of all the gasometers, which means and my father-in-law had dealings with that. And at one point, he actually climbed one of those things. At one point, he's terrible with heights as well. So I don't know how he managed that. But of course, because they haven't got these, there's no buffering in the system in Britain. We know, as per usual, Britain does everything on the cheap and cheerful. And then when things go wrong, you've got no resilience, and you're struggling, you know. But and I remember he said to me, and I think they were talking about something about this to do with the things that are happening just now in the world about gas supplies and whatnot. And I remember my father-in-law saying to me years ago that, you know, you can't stop gas supplies. If you were to stop the gas supply, you need to go around every household and turn a tap to seal it before you could bring it back up and then bleed it through one at a time or something daft like that. So,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, that just sounds unbelievable, you know?
Makes sense, though. Makes sense. Yeah. Wow. That's, I never thought of that.
No, yeah, most people don't. That's it. So, yeah, if Britain was to run out of gas, we'd be in a big trouble.
Yeah. We used to live in a town called Uxbridge, which is not far, it's just down the road from Heathrow Airport now. It wasn't Heathrow Airport then. But I remember we left when I was six, so my memory's a bit hazy. But I remember my dad would go to the local gas works, right? To get a barrow load of coke. And I used to go with him in the barrow. And but watching that place, what they were doing there was they were extracting the gas from coal, and the residue was coke, which has had a lot of the fractions removed from it. You know, because you've got coal tar and all that sort of stuff out of there.
So what does coke look like? Is it a solid? I mean, I don't even really.
Yeah, it looks like bits of coal, but it's all full of holes. It looks like pumice, you know.
And it
will burn for quite a long time on a coal fire, and you can use it to sort of supplement your coal, because we used to have coal that had quite a lot of. What was it like? It was quite tarry coal. You'd see it sort of melting and gunge coming out of it, and that would burn like mad once it got hot. But you put a bit of coke on top of that, and it would sort of keep it under control a bit, and it would also, you know, heat up and give you a good hot fire and whatever. Yeah. So yeah. The gas works is just down the road from where we lived. That's really the point of the story. So, and there's all gasometers around because they made the gas and put it into these gasometers, which, if you don't know, was a sort of cylindrical device, very large, size of a sort of block of houses type of thing, which you pumped gas into, and there was a cylinder that raised the thing, sort of grew higher and higher. inside it.
Yeah, it was kind of like telescopic, and the sections would rise up. There was like a frame round outside which it was attached to, and the different sections moved up as it was filled, sort of thing. Yeah, it's quite something.
Mm-hmm. You used to see gasometers beside the motorway on the way to Glasgow. I'm not sure if they're still there. A lot of people have kept them as a sort of piece of industrial archaeology.
I don't know. To tell you the truth, whether they're still there or not.
Yeah, I've not been that way for a time. Yeah. By train to Glasgow.
Yeah, very good.
Anyway,
enough.
Too much reminiscing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing how these topics can take you off down all different rabbit holes.
I'm sure it'd be quite interesting for people around the world that have no idea about how things are done back in the day in Britain, you know. But
Aye. It's no wonder that Uxbridge suffered from as bad a smog as London itself. I mean, it's sort of greater London was then. It was on the outskirts of London. You get tube from central London to Uxbridge, and that's where it terminated. So, yeah. But the smogs were dreadful. You know, I remember coming home from school through the smog. You could hardly see across the road. You know, you really had to sort of grope your way along by the edge of the pavement to find your way home.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a wee bit slightly before my time, but I'd imagine that, you know, Edinburgh would be quite smoky as well back in the day. You know, mm-hmm. I'd imagine they'd have the same problems as well. It'd be up and down the country, you know.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether the London area suffered because of the sort of geography of it, that it all the smoke and the fog. It was basically a fog, which then got filled with smoke because the smoke couldn't rise up high enough into the air.
Right.
It was kept down by the fog. But the first one of those in London killed loads of people.
Really,
wow. Anyway, yep. So that's enough reminiscing.
Right. Okay. So what was our next topic? You got a new ADSL. It's a bit more topic that people in HBR will be maybe familiar with, ADSL connections and stuff. So that sounds a bit fancy.
So I have had in this house, my connection to the internet has been ADSL, which is over a phone line, the street outside had cable installed some long time ago, but there's no way I want, because the deals were you buy their TV cable thingy from Virgin Media and then you get internet along with it, and there's no way I wanted all that junk coming into my telly. So I stayed with ADSL, which was not too bad. It was something like 19 megabits down, or maybe about 1.5 up. But, you know, that's, as ADSL goes, that's not too bad. But recently, within the past couple of years, there's a company that's been installing actual fiber along the street, and that's a company called City Fiber that's doing most of Scotland, quite a lot of England too, I think. I think it is the sort of main installer for fibre around the country. So they put all the infrastructure in. But then after they'd installed it, they had contracted to have only one supplier over it for, I don't know, a year, 2 years, I can't remember. I just happened to notice that there was some information that said such and such a company now available on City Fiber, and I realized that the ISP that I've been using all the time I've had internet was now available over fiber. So I was straight on the phone to book it. So I've got a fiber coming out of the wall of my house. They blew it. They actually connected it all up, put all the ducting in through my garden, and then they put it through the wall, and then they got this compressor thing, fed piece of fiber into the from a spool into the bit by the wall, and blew it out to the connection unit across the street. I knew that it was done. I've never seen that done before. It was amazing. It only took like 5 minutes. The guy's connecting the other end, and then another guy connected my end and put a box on the end of it. And there you go. He said, "Oh, that's you. You've got your fibre is up and running."
I thought when you said they blew it to start with, I thought they'd blown something up. You know,
it's called blown fibres. So it's just right. blown down the because the continuous ducts that go from your house to the junction box, effectively. I didn't actually get to see what the junction box looked like, but still, you know, still that's pretty cool.
Yeah, very good, very good. I mean, I don't think we've got we've got fibre, but not to the house. I think it's about 21, 22 down and up. I don't know what it is, 7 or 8. I'm not quite sure what it is. Up the way to tell the truth, but to tell you the truth, you know, I had before we got fibre, we had 0.75 down. You know, so it was rubbish. We actually had lower speed than the BBC said the slowest connection in Britain had. So I thought, now you're telling lies here. You know, it's nonsense. And of course, they were saying things, oh, you can't do browsing unless you've got, and I can't remember what it was, 2 or 5 megabits or something. That's rubbish. You know, I can browse internet perfectly satisfactory with 0.75. No problems whatsoever. It's just when you're doing streaming that's an issue. Nothing more than that. And I find with the 21, I mean, yeah, I would love 300. That would be amazing. But with the 21, I've no need for more than that. I mean, I've seen my wife streaming something. I think at one point we had the wife streaming something. I had the telly on, and I was upstairs streaming something, and it was all working fine. No issues. No dropouts. I seem to have a good stable connection. And I got, of course, the ISP I'm with, every so often they'll come back and say, oh, if you stay with us for 18 months, we'll give you this deal. And they kind of do it in the middle of your, or when you're in three quarters of your contract. It's a wee bit sneaky to sort of lock you in. But on the other hand, it's cheaper, so you're saving money and you're getting more. Mm-hmm. And of course, they threw at me in a new router and an Amazon, what do you call it, an Amazon Alexis thing, is it, or something like that?
Echo. So that's Echo.
So it's sitting in a cupboard along with a router, because I can't be bothered reconfiguring this new router to and it probably have faster Wi-Fi, but again, everything's stable and solid and working fine. I just can't be bothered changing the old ones. I'm just stuck with the old thing. So
no, fair enough. I got a new router with my CityFibre connection. My ISP. Pushing a different router for fiber, obviously, than the ADSL one. But it came with wireless 6, which I'd not even heard of.
Oh,
but
wow.
You do get much better coverage. It used to be with my old ADSL router that when the family turned up and, you know, with multiple phones and tablets and Apple Watches and whatever, they would kill the router. It was like too many wireless connections and just fall over. But this one has dealt with everything that's been thrown at it and kept things really, really quick. So
that's good, because I think my mother, she got a new router, and she always complains that, you know, the connection isn't as stable as it was before. And always in the back of my mind, everything's a kind of compromise that you know, if you're trying to squirt more bandwidth down the line over Wi-Fi, or maybe you're spreading across a wider spectrum of frequencies or whatever, I don't know, but I could imagine that while it might be faster, it could also be a less robust connection. But obviously, it seems not to be the case for yourself. And
no, so it seems to be really robust compared to what it was. I've actually got quite a lot of Ethernet connections around the house. In fact, I'm sitting here next to the kitchen table, and I've got an 8-port or 5-port switch on the table there, which you can switch on. So because the scenario was several people would arrive, i.e. my kids and their friends or whatever, and they would have laptops, and they'd try the wireless, and it was really awful. And then I'd say, well, just switch that switch on. Take one of those cables, plug it in, and you find everything will be good. And it was, you know, routers would handle multiple Ethernet.
Right.
But I don't really need that anymore.
That's good. It's really good.
Not for them, anyway.
Just shows you. I mean, it's probably just complete laziness on my part, you know, because I've got IP addresses, and of course I had a wee BT router years ago, and you could add almost limitless fixed IP addresses. But I think this it's actually I think it's limited to 7 or 8 or something like that. And I think some of the, I have to really be careful which ones I fix because it's so limited what it can do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's fixed from the router end rather than from the individual device. So when it sees a particular MAC address, it assigns a particular IP. Mm-hmm. But yep. Whether that's the best way to do it, or whether I should do it from the device itself, who knows? But I can't be bothered, so I'm just too lazy.
I don't know the answer to that, actually. I've pondered that one. My new router, I spent a bit of time putting in all of the MAC address to fixed address details and stuff for the DHCP service, and that's what I do. All my Raspberry Pis have got fixed addresses and so on and so forth. Just makes life so much easier. But you could do it the other way around. I think Ken has done that in his home setup. I've never really talked to him about the pros and cons. So
I think a chap I knew he set a range up above that and kept that allocation at the bottom free, and then they just assigned them manually within each device sort of thing. I thought, well, maybe that's the way to do it.
I don't know really. I found the downside with my new router is that it can't do what the previous one did. The DHCP, you can, it's part of the protocol, you can nominate your DNS server for each device. Right. I don't know if you can configure it per device, but you can certainly configure it such that things that get DHCP addresses get a different DNS. So that's how the Pi-hole system works, or can work. Mm-hmm. Pi-hole is the thing that intercepts advertising calls to advertisers and just throw some dev nulls and whatever it does to them. But it, in order for Pi-hole to work, you need to nominate it as your local DNS.
Ah, right.
And I can't do that with this router. For some reason, the guy at the ISP I was talking to, I said, why can't it do this? And he said, I don't know, actually. I've never come across this before. This is a new router that they've just started to roll out to customers. So I'm going to hassle them about this again soon, I think. But you can. I've got two possible strategies. One is to bring up one of the ADSL routers just as a non-ADSL, but just something sitting on the network, and then use its DHCP, which I know can do that.
Right.
So I'm nearly there, but I just haven't got to the point of throwing the switch yet. There's always a demand for the network here.
Yeah.
finding downtime is not always easy. The other thing you can do is you can run DNS on the Pi-hole itself, DNS and DHCP, I should say. So you could just switch off DHCP everywhere and just point everything. Obviously, you can point your router at the DNS you need to, and the DNS can be your local Pi-hole machine. So though how you get that to have a fixed address, I'm not sure at the moment. But anyway, but yes, so it will then handle the DHCP and the DNS and do all the magic that it's supposed to do, which is pretty nice. It means anybody coming in this house immediately gets their all the connections to known advertisers blocked, which some people find is a pain if they're specifically using vendors, you know, people who are doing, you know, collecting tokens or something like that, that gives them shopping
discounts. No, I don't do any of that, I must admit. but I'm just a bit lazy, really, and just kind of pragmatic these days. But it's an age thing or whatever, but I just let it do away sort of thing, you know. I don't really worry too much about that, but yeah.
I blame COVID myself, but there you go.
quite right. Sounds reasonable.
You've got to blame something. but indeed. Have I talked more than you? I think I might have done.
Well, no, it's okay. It doesn't need to be to balance or anything like that. I don't know how much, I mean, how far we go from here. I mean, I had a wee bit about bad weather, but that kind of fringes in what we're talking about with the boilers and stuff. And then I had to think about, well, I've got a Chromebook, so I could kind of mention that sort of thing, which I'm quite enjoying. It's just laziness and convenience. I'm using it just now for these show notes. You just flip it open and it's instantly on, flip it closed, it's instantly off again. So that is really, really convenient. And for the simplicity of just getting online, you know, because during the week, my room is converted into an office, and I've got to, you know, put everything away and set things up and whatnot. So I can't get access to my PC. So from that point of view, just to get online to do online stuff that people need to do. I mean, it's now at the stage where you really need an internet connection to survive in society. Almost, it's very difficult otherwise. You know, and my wife's parents obviously find that a bit of a problem because they've not got the internet. My mother's quite tech savvy, but yeah, and so the Chromebook. I had a curious problem with the Chromebook. I was trying to do these notes and I had difficulty logging on to multiple accounts. We're using kind of Google notebook thing, Google Word, I think it is, and it wouldn't let me set up another account. Oh, it's just popped up. Stop it. It's picked up me saying that. No, shush, shush. I used that word that you should never utter, starting with a G, and so I won't utter it again. And I had to actually install Firefox on the Chromebook, and that allowed me to do a bit of that. But then I did a bit of googlinging, and it came out. It turned out, well, it was my wife that found it actually. It was down to a Hangouts Android app that I had installed, and it was kind of obsolete and had been replaced. And once I removed it, it allowed me to have multiple accounts. Because when I tried to create a new account, it would just go round and round in circles forever. And nothing I could do would solve it. So, yeah, obscure thing, Hangouts was causing a problem, bizarre.
Wow. Yes, I'm glad you managed to solve it. That would be very frustrating, I'm sure.
Yeah. As an example, just the other day, and this might be vaguely interesting or I don't know how much we'll get out of it, but the Scottish census has come through the door just the other day, and we had to fill that in, and that was ideal for the Chromebook. So the census happens every 10 years and asks a whole slew of questions about, you know, what kind of general questions, you know, not about your finances or whatever, but, you know, are you well, you know, do you speak Scots, whatever that means. things like that. Yeah, all these crazy questions.
Yeah, that's quite good, actually. There's been quite a lot of battling about the subject of Scots on Twitter that I've noticed. I mean, obviously, Gaelic is a language of its own, but is Scots a language is the thing, you know? The business of, say, I ken instead of I know, and all those sorts of words that you find in Scotland, which are, I think, are wonderful and delightful. Sometimes they sound amazing. but you know, are you being asked whether you speak those sorts of Scots words?
Yeah, well you go, there's a help section explaining. My mother got very confused about it. But I mean, it was talking about Glaswegian and various other bits and pieces. And the way I read it, well, if you can understand broad Scots, whatever that means, you know, if you were listening to Billy Connolly or an episode of what's it called, that that soap, Shield Inch and all that, you know, one of those things, then you would then that's you, you know. So, and I would say, yeah, and generally I can pick up most of the Scots sort of tongue and whatnot. So,
cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know. This might make our, this episode, flag it as, what's the word? Having, what's the word you use?
Explicit.
That's the word. Explicit. Yes, yes. Because just before I started this podcast, I had to go out and do as we call it, or I call it, Tolly Patrol. So there you go. I was out doing that. So that's all sorted and be ready for wife coming back. So.
Yes, there's a Twitter account called, is it Miss Penny Punny or Lenny Penny or something like that, but who's a linguist who gives you a Scots word of the day. And some of those are absolute gems, and then she explains it, speaks it, and then speaks it slower with subtitles, and then she explains what the word means. And
yeah, I remember a colleague was at a show, and I don't know, it was the Edinburgh Fringe or something. And there was a chap on, and he was trying to be funny and wasn't funny. He was going on about Scots words. Like, oh, these Scots words are great, you know. And he sort of picked on my colleague sort of thing. And said, oh, so you there, and he we've been asked at one point. So come on, say something then. So my colleague just turned and looked at him and said, away and bile your heed. And of course the whole audience fits of laughter. And he couldn't finish his show after that, you know. So.
That's the perfect response, yeah.
He was always very good at putting folk down, I must admit, you know. So.
I used to work with a guy who came from the Aberdeen area. He would sometimes drop into sort of Aberdonian accent. Well, it's not really an accent. There's different ways of saying things and different words. You say fit instead of what and stuff, don't you?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not massively up on it myself. But like you say, you get the gist of it, I would think, you know. So.
Yeah. Once you realise that there's a sort of shift in the way that things are said and different vocabulary, then, you know, you start to latch on to the whole business. I find it amazing and fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's all good of fun, isn't it? I mean, we're all sort of different. So, indeed. Well, I don't know if this is maybe quite a good. Is this a good place to break? Do you think, or do we go further?
Well, we in elapsed time. Hopefully, the final recording will be less than an hour. We've reached an hour elapsed time doing this. So we probably should call a halt at this stage, just for the sake of having
a reasonable
length show at the end of it. But indeed. It just goes to show how many things we need to catch up on and how many topics we have to chat about. We should do another one of these before too many weeks are out, you know?
Absolutely. And that would be good. Yeah, I look forward to that.
Yeah, it's fun. It's really fun to do this. It's a really interesting chat. So, all right, then, we'll call it quits now and maybe see everybody again in the not too distant future, hopefully.
How do we call off again? How is it you do it? You and Ken do it again?
We say there's some sort of preamble that Ken does, and I've completely forgotten what it is. But we take turns to say Hacker Public Radio. So goodbye from Hacker
Public
Radio.
There we go.
So there you go. That's it. Thanks very much, Mr. X. It's been great fun.
Yeah, me too. You're welcome. Cheers, everybody. Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HBR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.